Welcome to 30 Minutes on 91.3 KXCI Tucson. I'm Amanda Schager. Today on 30 Minutes, we'll continue with remarks from Amy Goodman's talk at the Leo Rich Theater. On April 28, 2016, Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman returned to Tucson for a talk and book signing. Goodman's talk was a benefit for KXCI Community Radio. During this 2016 election season, Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman is on a 100-city speaking tour to mark the 20th anniversary of the Daily Independent Global TV Radio News Hour with a new book titled Democracy Now! 20 Years Covering the Movements Changing America by Amy Goodman with David Goodman and Dennis Moynihan. In 1996, acclaimed independent journalist and best-selling author Amy Goodman began hosting a show on Pacifica Radio called Democracy Now! To cover the 1996 election. KXCI first began broadcasting Democracy Now! In October 1998. Democracy Now! Currently airs weekdays at noon. This is part three of a multi-part series.
Now, movements. The movements are what matters. You heard that Harriet Tubman might grace the front of a $20 bill soon. Now, that's been controversial. Some have said, how could it be that a former slave would be on U.S. currency representing capitalism? But others say it's the most used bill in the country, and now millions of people will see this image of an unbelievably brave woman who was enslaved in the eastern shore of Maryland. Frederick Douglass also was. He headed north. He escaped. She escaped about 10 years later. He became the greatest abolitionist, speaking out all over the country against slavery. She also made her way north, but came back, even though she was brutalized and beaten, as he was. It led to her having epileptic-like fits all her life from the beatings on her head, but she came back to the Eastern Shore to free hundreds of slaves. She led troops in the Civil War. She would have to fight for a pension for decades. She was a spy for the Union during the Civil War. An astounding woman, and it's a story we should hear all the time. And the reason that this has even happened and that she's pushing Andrew Jackson, the slave-holding president. 18 of our presidents own slaves, but she's pushing him to the back of the bill. And who knows if there won't be an outcry and he might be erased from the bill altogether. But that came not from the decision of the Treasury, but from grassroots pressure, hundreds of thousands of people petitioning for Jackson to be removed from the front of the bill. And that is so often the case. It's the movements that matter. So I want to talk about Frederick Douglass for a minute. He was born on the eastern shore of Maryland, right? He was enslaved as a youth and a teenager. It might not surprise you to know he was a troublesome slave. He was handed over to a slave breaker named Ed Covey, who had this plantation called Mount Misery. He tortured Frederick Douglass. He beat him. Frederick Douglass fought back, escaped, headed north, came to New York, took refuge in the printing press offices of David Ruggles, born a free black man in Connecticut, and Frederick Douglass would start the North Star newspaper. You know, Ruggles had the printing press. Frederick Douglass started the newspaper. These men saw the media as their form of liberation because information is power. So that building where Frederick Douglass took refuge in New York is now an independent coffee shop in downtown Manhattan. And this is how I learned the story, because I love this place. I love coffee. And outside the coffee shop is this plaque that tells us history. And then I looked into it. So in 2003, right around the time of the Iraq War, we read on the internet that that place, Mount Misery, was just bought by Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense at the time, who would use it as his vacation home in St. Michael's, Maryland, to be near his close friend, Vice President Dick Cheney. So when I read this, I said, wow, this is quite amazing. And especially for young people, but for everyone, you know, I read this online. We have to keep the internet open and free, not let the telecoms and the private corporations privatize the internet. It's the way we all grassroots globalize. Corporations have been doing that for a long time, but now the grassroots can speak to each other everywhere on the planet. But, and I say this especially to students, the internet can also be a global rumor mill, and you have to check, double check, triple check, quadruple check everything you read. And that's as it should be and as it always has been. So when I read this, I thought, is this possible? It's not enough that I'm reading it in a lot of places. So Dennis Moynihan and I headed down to St. Michael's, Maryland. I was going to speak like in Washington about an hour or two later, so we thought we'd just make a little side trip and check into this matter. So we went to St. Michael's, Maryland, and I realized as we're coming into town with very little time to do this deep investigation, I had no idea where Donald Rumsfeld lives and how was I going to find out. But then I saw an independent coffee shop on the horizon. I thought, oh, they'll tell the truth. So I went in and they said, what would you like? And I said, I'd like to know where Donald Rumsfeld lives. And they said, oh, you just go down the road, you'll hit Mount Pleasant Road. Don't go down that road. Make a right, another right, and you'll hit Mount Misery Road. Go down the road, and he lives at the end. So we were on to something. We went down the road, didn't go down Mount Pleasant Road, made a right and another right, seemed we couldn't go right enough, and made it to the end. And we knew we were there because that was where the Secret Service, you know, black-tinted windows, the vehicles was. And I got out of the car with my little video camera, and I was zooming in as they were zooming out. And I was thinking, does Secretary Rumsfeld understand the significance of this property, this plantation he owns? And sure enough, I saw the stake in the ground next to the driveway, Mount Misery. And so we raced down the road, this dusty dirt road in St. Michael's, and saw this old black church. It was a Sunday morning. We went into the church, and people were having Sunday school. And I went up to a woman and I said, excuse me, I was wondering if you could talk about the significance of this place. You know, it's so historic. Frederick Douglass was born here. He was enslaved here. He was brought to Mount Misery and he was tortured there. And now the owner of Mount Misery, Donald Rumsfeld, who's known for torture, right? I mean, we're talking about Abu Ghraib. We're talking about Guantanamo and his response to all of the exposés. You know, when people were forced to stand for hours on end, not sleep, he said he also doesn't get much sleep and he stands for a long time too. So I said, you know, this whole place from Frederick Douglass to Donald Rumsfeld, what do you say about this? And the woman looked at me and said, we're in church right now. I can't comment. So from Mount Misery to Mount Hope, I was speaking up in Rochester, New York. I was telling this story. And a student came up to me afterward and said, would you come with me to Mount Hope Cemetery? It was in the middle of a snowstorm. I was flying to Denver at like 6 o'clock in the morning. And I said, I'm sorry, I won't be able to make it because I have to fly out at 6. And she said, I'll meet you at 4 in front of the cemetery because I'd like to show you Frederick Douglass's tombstone. How amazing. And, you know, that kind of persistence and determination. How could I say no? So I said, okay, I'll meet you in front of the cemetery. And there she was in her snow jacket covered in snow. And we trudged over to Frederick Douglass's tombstone. It was amazing. We were wiping the snowflakes off. And then she said, would you come with me to another tombstone? I said, oh my God, I'm going to miss my flight. And she said, please. Okay, we'll go quickly. So we go over to this vast cemetery to the other side of it. And there is Susan B. Anthony buried next to her sister. And you know, Susan B. Anthony and Frederick Douglass weren't just allies. They were friends. I told this story at Wesleyan College in Connecticut, and a woman came up after and she said, and did you go to Susan B. Anthony's house? Because near it is a statue of Frederick Douglass and Susan B. Anthony having tea together. Yes, they were not only allies, but friends. And so we saw these tombstones. I raced off to the airport and I missed my flight. So I'm standing in the middle of the airport, horrified because I was supposed to speak in Denver and I was disappointing people. And I call up Dennis quickly and I said, Dennis, you have to get me on the next flight. I can't even tell you why, but I have missed the flight. And I, of course, then I told him why. And I said, I was at the cemetery and I'm so sorry. And he says, I said, you just got to get me some tickets. He says, okay, I've just brought up the blueprints of the Rochester airport. I said, he's an unbelievable researcher. I said, but how does this help me? I know where I am. I said, I just need some tickets. He said, I need to know where you're standing right now. I said, oh my God, what? Okay. I am standing in the middle of the airport. He said, no, are you in the Susan B. Anthony wing or are you in the Frederick Douglass wing? I said, are you kidding? oh my God. And I see to my right is the Frederick Douglass Terminal, and there is his name. And over here it says Susan B. Anthony. You know, every once in a while you have to smell the coffee. And he got me tickets and I made it to Denver. These movements, right? The abolition movement, the women's rights movement. Oh, one other thing. Susan B. Anthony wasn't just a women's rights activist, she was an abolitionist. And Frederick Douglass wasn't only an abolitionist, he was a leading women's rights supporter. He was at the Seneca Falls Women's Rights Convention. He was the one who seconded the call for women to have the right to vote even before many women believed that maybe the time was right for women to be able to vote. Yes, the women's movement, the abolition movement, the suffrage movement, moving forward the civil rights movement, the gay and lesbian movement, the environmental movement, the anti-war movement, the immigrants' rights movements. These are the movements that have made this country great. Movements matter. And now I want to turn to 1 year. You know, in Democracy Now!, the book, 20 years covering the movements changing America, we look at the 20 years of the coverage we have done on Democracy Now! It's not an exhaustive look. It's not a greatest hits. It simply brings you, as we say at the end of our introduction, this book is just our way of giving back by celebrating some of the ordinary heroes who've done extraordinary things to make the world a better place. And I can't talk about Democracy Now! Without talking about my co-host Juan Gonzalez, who has been with Democracy Now! For the full 20 years. Juan is also a columnist with the New York Daily News for the next few minutes. He has been a columnist for 29 years at the New York Daily News, which was the biggest newspaper, city newspaper in the country. And we had the honor, the whole Democracy Now! Team a few months ago, to go to Midtown Manhattan and to see Juan, the first Latino journalist inducted into the New York Journalism Hall of Fame. What a speech he gave. I mean, the New York Times were there, the CBS, each one had a table, the Daily News had a table. Of course, Democracy Now! Had two tables, his other DN. And when he stood up to give his speech, we all stood up and said, Juan Gonzalez presente. They put the award around his neck. And Juan got up and he put the other inductees to shame with his speech. Oh, like Charlie Rose and Leslie Stahl. This is a part of what Juan said about his quarter of a century as a columnist. He said, I figured my modest contribution would be not writing about outcast neighborhoods, but from them. Not simply to entertain, but to change. Not after the fact, but before it, when coverage could still make a difference. He said, I've tried to use as many of my columns as possible to probe the injustices visited upon the powerless. Yes, the rich and famous also are victims on occasion, but they have so many politicians, lobbyists, lawyers, gossip columnists, and even editorial writers ready to jump to their defense that they'll always do fine without my help. He said, I prefer the desperate unknown reader who comes to me because he or she has gone everywhere else and no one will listen. More often than not, I come across unexpected gems, human beings whose tragedies illuminate the landscape and whose courage hopefully inspires the reader to believe that there is indeed some greater good served by a free press than just chronicling or influencing the ouster of one group of politicians by another. So Juan is retiring from the New York Daily News after 29 years. He'll become a professor of journalism at Rutgers University in New Jersey. I mean, when this was announced, I mean, the mayor of New York tweeted this. All the great journalists talked about this. He's a leading journalist of our time. And I am so proud that even as he leaves the Daily News, his other DN he will continue with. And you will continue to hear Juan on Democracy Now!
You are listening to remarks from Amy Goodman's Tucson stop of Democracy Now!'s 100 City Speaking Tour in conjunction with the 20th anniversary of the program and their new book titled Democracy Now! 20 Years Covering the Movements Changing America.
So I want to talk about 1 year. Examples of the movements that have mattered in this country. 2011. At the end of 2010, Tunisian Revolution. A young man comes out of university. There's no opportunity. There's a corrupt despot, a brutal despot. This young man has no opportunity, so goes in the marketplace to sell vegetables and fruit. The authorities harass him, steal his scale. He can't take it anymore. He sets himself on fire. His name is Mohamed Bouazizi. And that really sparks the Tunisian revolution. Other things did as well. WikiLeaks, for example. You know WikiLeaks, founded by Julian Assange, now moving into his fourth year imprisoned, basically, at the Ecuadorian embassy in London. I mean, he could step out. He has political exile there. Ecuador is not imprisoning him. It's a tiny little embassy, as you know if you're a regular viewer or listener of Democracy Now! I've been going there several times to interview him about his work, which he continues. But he's afraid if he steps foot outside, ultimately he will be extradited to the United States and could face treason. We believe there's a sealed indictment against him. Charges, could be imprisoned for the rest of his life. And if you think, oh, that's a little paranoid, there's a name, Chelsea Manning, ring a bell, who has been convicted and sentenced to like 37 years in jail, convicted of releasing documents that she felt as a young U.S. soldier in Iraq, figured out access to get these documents, that the American people should see them, that they were, some of them were evidence of war crimes, and that someone had to see them outside those that deemed them classified. So there's Julian Assange, there is Chelsea Manning, Glenn Greenwald, who recently was here, right, with Noam Chomsky, and streaming in Ed Snowden, another major patriotic whistleblower, who in the midst of Chelsea Manning's court-martial recognized that he had documents that showed that the U.S. government was spying on the American people, and thought, given what was happening to Chelsea at the time, Bradley Manning, that, you know, you couldn't hear Manning's voice for years. Democracy Now! Did broadcast Manning's voice. It was secretly recorded in the courtroom when Manning testified. You could hardly understand it. It was a secret, very muffled recording. But we felt it was absolutely critical to even understand that for all of these years, you could never hear this person again. And this is what Snowden was concerned about. Not actually hearing him, Edward Snowden, but that he could never get these documents out if he stayed in this country and released them. So he went to Hong Kong. He got in touch with these great journalists, Laura Poitras and Glenn Greenwald. They actually, very bravely, went to Hong Kong, not knowing, having any idea who this man was, but just somehow trusting or having an instinct and knowing they'd have to investigate when they got to Hong Kong. And they met him. They videoed him. They did article after article going through the documents that he had. President Obama first said, you know, this is a very important discussion to have. We would have had it without Ed Snowden. Really? Really? I mean, the administration, it's not just Obama's, it was Bush before, they encourage whistleblowers to take documents because until they actually show the documents, they say they're lying. And then when confronted with their own government documents, the Iraq war logs, the Afghanistan war logs, well, this was WikiLeaks, the State Department cables. In the case of Ed Snowden, it was the NSA documents. When confronted with them, they have to back off and admit that these are actual records of what the U.S. government has done over time and what they're doing today and what they will do into the future unless people make up their own minds. And that's Snowden's point, by the way. He says, it's not so much him going to jail. That's not so much what he's concerned about. He's concerned that the American people won't get to debate this. And he doesn't even have a direction he necessarily wants the American people to go in. But he says you have to know to make up your own minds. What do you want your government to be? What do you want your government to do? So we have a chapter on whistleblowers in this book. And by the way, if you get two copies of the book, you get a copy of this amazing DVD with Glenn Greenwald that we had the day of this big meeting he had here, this big, how many of you went? Yes, Glenn and Snowden and Chomsky. We interviewed him in the morning here in a studio, and Nermeen Sheikh and I, my co-host for the last 5 years, and we talked for about an hour and a half on the show, after the show, and we have this special DVD if you get two copies of the book. Now, why get two copies of the book? So I want to talk a little about the politics of book selling and what it means. First of all, it is so wonderful to see Antigone's again here. We have you know, come through Tucson a number of times, and it is wonderful that Antigone's continues. So many bookstores in this country fold, thousands of them, the independents. And these, like libraries, which I revere, and on this 100-city tour, we spoke at the Eagle Public Library in Colorado, at the Carbondale Public Library in Colorado. I love libraries. My dad sat on a library board, our local library board, for 25 years. The library was my living room. I went there all the time. For years, I spoke in a very hushed voice because the librarians were always hushing me, so I just decided it wasn't worth the trouble. I'll just always whisper. But I love libraries, independent bookstores. When other people would come into New York for Broadway plays or whatever, we grew up about an hour and a half outside. My family, I would come in with my brothers and my parents to the first Barnes & Noble. You know, before it became a chain, it was in New York City. And that's where we'd spend the day, just browsing the books, reading stories. That was my parents and our greatest love. I was just telling the story of my parents once came in to visit me in New York City, and we went out to a restaurant in the Village. And when we came out, their car was gone. It was stolen. And and so we're looking around, and there was someone on a stoop at a brownstone. We said, "Did you see our car by any chance? Did you see who took it?" We didn't know if it was towed or if it was stolen. We go to the police stations. They didn't help us. So then we got a cab, and we go into all the towing lots of New York, you know, along the Hudson River to try to find our poor car. And then my pet was hopeless, and my parents had to go home. And you know, we're just looking, and the cab driver was helping us look. And so I bring them to the Long Island Railroad so that they can go home. And it was the first time my father had expressed any emotion in this entire ordeal of their car stolen. As he's getting out of the car, out of the cab, he says to his wife, Dee, honey, he says to her, "Was my book in the car?" And I mean, it was like this $4.99 paperback ripped up. He said, "We're going to go on the train. Where's my book?" So they get on the train, and I'm with the cab driver, and the cab driver said, "This is unbelievable." He said, "Your father hardly said anything until he realized his book was in this car." A few days later, the police called. The car was found in a known drug location in Brooklyn. And of course, my father immediately said, "Was there a kind of dog-eared book in the back seat? I need my book." And that's what I grew up with. In my house growing up, I mean, the bookshelves were the wallpaper of the entire house. My father used a wheelchair. He had MS. And when we were selling the house so they could move into a smaller house, you know, all the people were coming in. They were selling off everything or the things that they couldn't take with them, which was horrifying to my dad. And so he's wheeling around, and all of a sudden we said, you know, people are looking at all the books and they're pulling it down. And we said, "Hey, where's Dad?" We couldn't find him. And we go into the living room. He is facing the corner in his chair. And he's got books on his lap that are this high. We said, "Dad, what are you doing?" He said, "I'm buying them back." I said, "Dad, they're your books. You can't take them all." And he said, "No, I want to be fair about this." And the next person who walks by, he's grabbing all their books. You know, they're coming to have them pay. They're paying for them. He's saying, "No, I'll pay you to keep my own books." But so it's our life, right? It's what we have always, what brought us together. It's what we debated at every meal is books. And so we were totally amazed that on April 12th, when the book came out, the next week, this book debuted on the New York Times bestseller list. Now that is amazing given the fact that the New York Times never mentions Democracy Now! We've had six books, never reviews any of the books. Yep, they've all hit the New York Times bestseller list. And the reason this is important is they won't mention Democracy Now! And so the only way we can get it into the paper of record is this, just by the simple mathematical equation, they're forced to print, you know, that this book. And so we thought we'd be so explicit on this one, we'd actually call it Democracy Now! And they would have to put it there. But more seriously, this is why it's so important. In those libraries we love, the independent bookstores, the independent media, all of these I consider sanctuaries of dissent. And libraries, sadly, increasingly, just choose the bestsellers. And we want people, especially who come into libraries who might not be able to afford to buy books, to be able to see this book, to read this book. Even bookstores, and sadly some independents, only buy the bestsellers. And great people go into these bookstores, hoping to enrich their minds, to challenge their imaginations, to travel through countries and centuries and meet people and never go actually physically anywhere, but just open up a book. And in these bookstores that only stock the bestsellers, we want to be there too, because we want to provide a roadmap to these other universes and galaxies of independent thought, to the whole world of independent media. And so, if you want to get two books, you can give one to a library, you can stockpile gifts for friends, you get this Glenn Greenwald DVD. And we're going to be signing and personalizing afterwards. And if you want to get one book, that's great. And if you don't want to get any book, that's fine too. Come up and say hi. If you want to tell us ideas for stories, actually we're broadcasting here tomorrow morning at 5 from the PBS station. Let me know those ideas, or probably more effective is to email them today or any day to stories@democracynow.org. This is how we find many stories. It's absolutely amazing. You know, we began on 9 community radio stations in 1996, and now we're broadcasting in over 1,400 public radio, public television, PBS, NPR, community radio stations in this country and around the world.
We'll have to leave it there. You've been listening to remarks made by Amy Goodman at the Tucson stop of Democracy Now!'s 100 City Speaking Tour, in conjunction with the 20th anniversary of the program and their new book titled Democracy Now! 20 Years Covering the Movements Changing America. This is part 3 of a multi-part series. Thanks for listening to 30 Minutes on 91.3 KXCI Tucson.